Put it on there.
Yeah, all right, we're on there. All right, figure it out. That was really dumb, whatever it was. Okay. All right, we're on the air.
Oh, my God.
All right.
So exciting.
Yeah, wait, see, no, we're going straight. Okay, we're on the air. All right, thank you, Juan.
All right.
Try to listen on my computer so you can.
Yeah, can you check just to make sure? All right. Thank you, Guan. All right. Now you're listening to Riffin, a very professional show run by Max Mislansky, and my guest is Monica Maioli, who has been kindly standing aside as we're trying to figure out our technical difficulties because I self-run my show. Those of you may not know this, and whew, it's hot up here. And yeah, we just figured it out, though. Not too bad. We're 7 minutes in, so I would say that we didn't lose too much time. So, Monica, how are you?
I'm better now.
Okay, good, good. All right, you're not too sweaty. I'm sweating more than you. It's I feel
yes,
like
you
it.
Are.
Yeah,
you are.
I'm in the hot seat in a
red
way.
And, yeah.
So
dewy.
Yeah, you're very dewy right now. So, Monica, I wanted to ask you a number of things. The first thing is that I remember when we had talked before that you're actually from Los Angeles, which is not entirely a common thing,
I feel like,
for a lot of our creative brethren.
Yes, yeah. I hail from Los Angeles circa 1963. And I think, well, we talked about your, yeah, we had a nice exchange about our childhoods here in the 70s, I think. Well,
yeah.
No, wait. When were you born?
I was born a wee bit after you, but yeah, I was more of a child of the 80s, where had more of a lick of the 70s.
Yeah,
so actually, like, I don't think we talked about this, but like, what was LA like in the 70s?
It was kind of dreamy. It was very, well, I mean, everything seems dreamy because it's...
Because it's memory.
It's memory, and I was a child, and so, of course, everything seems stress-free. And but, yeah, things were much slower and very smoggy here.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Extremely smoggy, and earthquakes punctuated. Some radical earthquakes were punctuating.
What was the big one? The Sylmar in the early 70s? Wasn't that the huge one?
Yes, I just remember a number of dodging under door frames and things like that.
Crazy.
That were, yeah.
Did you actually...
Those were exciting times.
Did you actually flock to see the film Earthquake when it came out in 78 or 77? That was a big blockbuster at the time.
Yeah. No, it was. I don't know. Now my students sort of laugh at me because I don't even skip a beat when there's an earthquake happening. I don't even take a breath.
Awesome.
Yeah, I just go on with whatever I'm talking about.
You're so used to it at this point.
I'm from Los Angeles, yeah.
I get kind of excited by earthquakes. Like, I don't ever really feel like I'm in imminent danger, though my partner Nancy always thinks, like, the world's about to end when an earthquake happens. Like, I'm so weirdly casual about it. But I feel like maybe I'm just kind of built where I don't really ever feel danger hit me that hard, that fast, in sort of natural disaster situation. And I haven't been many.
But have you been here? You've been here during the really rough, the 94 earthquake?
Yeah, I've been through all of it. I was here for the riots. I was here for the all that stuff. But yeah, it never affected me directly, ever really, in a way. Like, my house growing up never sustained any damage. Did you have anything like that?
No.
Never?
Never lost anything.
You grew up where? On the west side?
Yes. Well, sort of, yeah. Fairfax area. Then we moved to Beverly Hills, and then we moved... Finally, as in my late teens, we moved to Santa Monica, and then I moved to Silver Lake, and I lived there for 20 years.
Okay, wait. So you moved to Silver Lake as a grown up woman?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
What did your parents do?
My mother was an art professor at Loyola Marymount University and a painter, and my father was had a press in Milan, a lithographic press in Milan. So
designing or just printing?
He did art. He did sort of art artist prints.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you grew up in a very cultivated household.
Yes. Yeah. I grew up. I was thinking. I grew up surrounded by nude bodies. You know, nudes. I would refer to them as nudes when children would come over my ears.
Okay. Yeah. Because so
would
did
be
I.
Like, you have naked people up on the wall, and I'd be like, "Oh, that's a nude. Yeah, that's a nude."
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
And were your parents, like, you know, very liberal politically, obviously? Were a lot of their kind of hanging out in the art world in L.A.? Or were they sort of keeping to themselves more?
Well, first off, I've never met my father, so I didn't know my father. My mother left my father when she was pregnant with me. They were in Rome. And she left.
You've never had contact with your dad ever?
No.
Oh, wow.
No.
Is he still around?
No, he passed away, I think, we don't exactly know, but a few years ago, we think.
Okay. You think? Wow.
Well, yeah, he has a Wikipedia page, and that's how it was discovered by my brother.
Crazy.
Yeah, that he died in Ravenna. He was under deaths in Ravenna. That's how
you found out.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people, it's always said, like, when you know, especially when one's parents get older, you always go, oh, you should get square with them before they go. Do you have any sort of like regrets about not making contact with them?
Yeah,
you do.
Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure.
So anyway, so you grew up with your mother and she is in LA hanging out. And what did she expose you to? Did she have a lot of artist friends at the time?
Yes, she did. But she was teaching at a Catholic university. So it was a whole, she encountered a lot of, a lot of disapproval, I guess, or judgment around her work.
Right. And what kind of work did she make?
Well, she mostly works in still life, and she still works now, but she also...
And that's not Catholic enough for them?
Well, yes, she works with still life, but she also worked with nudes, and the nudes are nudes that I referred to were the things that...
Oh, right.
That they found questionable, like where a hand was positioned or someone's legs were splayed or, you know, that kind of thing. So it was a strange environment. But yes, she had eccentric friends whom I enjoyed very much. She went to UCLA as well. So yes, I was exposed to some rather eccentric, wonderfully eccentric artists as a child. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. And I grew up in a household where there was a lot of nudity as well. Like my parents were sort of in the entertainment industry. So my mother always had a lot of friends. There were photographers. They were bringing people over to get photographed, nude, un-nude. She collected a lot of photographs, you know, having that kind of thing. But also was exposed to a lot of television in the 80s when cable started to come around. So obviously, like, I was late up at night watching skin flicks and things like that, but nobody really were sort of actively making, well, that's not necessarily true. I guess I'm trying to get at is, like, having grown up around that, did you immediately know that you wanted to kind of be a part of that, or was there some kind of resistance?
No, there was no resistance. My mother, being a professor, would set up things for us, for my brother and I have an older brother, for us to sort of keep us quiet. She, you know, she was a single mother, and she was, I think, rather stressed from her job and the sort of the demands on her. And so she would try to kind of keep us occupied. And what she would do was set up the things that the students had done at college, that, you know, her university students had done that day. So we were both pretty absorbed by making things. And then I became really, I don't know if I'd say obsessed, but I mean, I, like, we would go on vacation and I would sit in the room and paint or draw.
Right.
Rather than, you know, go out. And I was completely absorbed by art, actually, as a child. And it became really a survival tool for me.
Survival in what sense, do you think?
Well, I think as being, you know, I guess, well, in so many ways, I think just being homosexual from an early, understanding that I was gay from an early age, it was a way that I... on probably almost every artist, you connect with other kids and adults through your work, through making things sort of approved of through your work. And so essentially that was very much true for me. I connected with my peers through, you know, just my drawing and painting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that wasn't so much, I was odd, but I wasn't, but I was strange in multiple ways, not just...
Right.
Not just being a gay child, but also being kind of an artistic child, and sort of, so in that sense I would say that it really was a kind of survival tool for me.
Huh.
But also just because it, yeah, it allowed me this sense of knowing myself and being a kind of, as I, it still does the same thing for me now. It essentially, because it's a reflection, right? So it feels like it's a way to know oneself. And the way to, for me, it was a way for me to know myself in a sense.
Right, right,
and
right.
To establish who I was to myself.
Right. And did, it seems, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but we're, to know your own sexual preference at a very young age seems, is that rare? I don't know. I feel like I just didn't know what to think about anything until I was like 13 or 14.
Yeah.
You know? Like, that's my like earliest memory of actually having a strong attraction to the opposite sex or whatever my preference was. Mm-hmm. So it seems like, I mean, some people keep it to themselves for a lot longer, of course, like whatever that is, but
well, I was sort of, my mom and I were talking about this the other night at dinner, because there's so much stuff around transgender issues now. But I actually wanted to be a boy when I was a girl.
Mm.
And so, and she was really supportive. I mean, she was very...
Like, not a tomboy, but you literally wanted to be a boy.
I wanted to be, yeah. I think it was beyond that.
Right.
And she was very, really progressive about just, kind of letting me dress the way I wanted to dress. And and never made a big deal out of it at all. So, I mean, for the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, that's really pretty... unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. That is. Yeah.
So I never felt self-conscious about it.
Huh.
But I think maybe that early identification of myself as a kind of more masculine person, I guess, or that's how I perceived myself at that time. I think that had something to do with how, at 9, that I came to feel that I was gay, and I also really identified. With the gay people that I saw, especially men, gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt a real affinity, and then I recognized myself in them. So I would say, and actually I was talking to Larry Pittman and Roy Dowell the other day about it, and they both said it was at 9 also that they recognized that they were homosexual. So I think, I don't know if it's maybe the difference, and that's why you're very sensitive to the differences or your differences.
Right.
So that makes you kind of sensitive to that proclivity or something? That you're not the same?
Especially if your parents are, or you know, vocally open to whatever you're interested in, where, you know, I feel like that would be a little easier environment. But
yes.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, one could come from a household of where you're not even really allowed to speak your voice.
That's right.
So, you know, things can get twisted from there pretty quick, I would think.
Yeah, for sure.
But having grown up, so obviously grown up in this kind of household, like, can you remember, like, the first thing you made that you were actually deeply proud of in any kind of meaningful way?
Hmm. Wow. Oh. First thing.
Or maybe it could have been something that somebody actually pointed out to you, like, hey, you're onto something. Because I feel like I had experience like that growing up.
Really? What was that? What did you
make? I was like in an art class and I made this drawing and my art teacher at the time was like, can I take this? And I thought maybe I was in trouble or I did something wrong or whatever. But then at the end of the class, he was like, you know, this is really good. I want to keep this in a safe place. And then he encouraged me to make more like them. And I was like, sure.
Oh my God.
So it was like kind of like the first moment where it was something that I made that somebody else could actually say, oh, you have something to say in some form or another. Like,
right.
I had some kind of agency.
Yes.
You know?
I think when I became a feminist when I was about 12 or so. I was sort of on the turbo.
Yeah, turbo mode, for sure.
To my separatism, which happened around 15.
Uh-huh.
And I think... Yeah, I was making very aggressive, I would say, now looking back, and I've kept it, interestingly, I didn't keep a lot of my UCLA undergraduate work, but I kept a lot of this early high school work. So I would say, yes, in high school, I started making really intense feminist work that was sort of working with pornography, but in a way that was about pornography as a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of overt sexuality in the work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I had, and I don't know if you know who Lamont Westmoreland is, but he was my high school teacher in Santa Monica.
And which school was this?
This was, I think this was our, because, yeah, it was Santa Monica High.
Samo for you locals. Yeah.
So he was also just a person that, he made an impression on me. He was very serious, and he treated us with a certain seriousness, and and I remember, and that was something too. That was significant for me as a person developing to be recognized somehow by someone who was obviously an artist,
right?
Somehow involved in the art world and knew, sort of an important person in a certain kind of art world in Los Angeles. So.
Yeah, it's sort of like that your teacher or mentor or whatever who is a practicing artist or has been doing it a long time, that is sort of like the ultimate validation. Because before that, everyone's sort of usually impressed by like, oh, you can draw something that looks realistic. You can draw a shoe and it looks like a shoe.
Right, exactly.
So that's sort of like the great moment right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So with this, these works that you were making kind of using pornography, do you still feel the same way about it now than as you did then in terms of it being
a
bad thing?
Well, it took a turn. No, of course not. It took a turn, obviously. I've been working with... Well, I guess what's interesting is that early work was... What I do, which is I work with a sort of documentary sexual image, which is really often a starting point for me, whether it's my own experience or someone I know or public somehow in some way.
Right.
So, no, it's opposite, quite opposite. Somewhere along the line, I just became interested in the explicit kind of quality of the material, of the sexual material and this kind of charge or the kind of... the embodiment that happens, or the viewer experiencing their own embodiment in relationship to a sexual image, which is factual, which in other words is photographic.
Right. Were you using found imagery from things that you were culling from magazines or film, or were you actually staging things, or how would that work exactly? To actually just literally get the information.
Yes. Well, I mean, of course that changed, but really this early work that I was making in the early 90s was all from, well, first it started with porn, and then very quickly was about my friend Paul and his experiences, and then I would restage his experiences. So he would pose for me, and I would use like the light from his body to kind of recreate a scene, and then also use him as a sort of protagonist in the paintings. So, and then he also photographed me. They were sort of experiences that I would have, and then I realized that they could have some kind of greater symbolic meaning apart from just, a sexual experience.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So it was all it was staged in a sense, recreations, but they weren't simulations. In other words, I the fact that he was playing all the characters, for instance, and so there was always this idea of a kind of collaging together of images. So I was using men from porn and just using the light from his body, but then interweaving images of him into that scene.
Right, right, right.
Rather than getting a bunch of guys together.
So it's sort of like a composite of some sort.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I like those kinds of blips and slippages and interruptions that were happening. That interested me.
And like as far as the actual construction or facture of the image, like were you sort of considering it sort of like you use the word documentary, it's almost that almost sort of implies at least on a street level way, like sort of a certain objectivity, if you will,
even though
it's not, but there is some kind of frizzing there of objectivity. And the way you were painting that stuff, especially as I could tell in the early 90s, it did remind me a lot of like Netherlandish painting or something like that. Is that something that kind of you were thinking about or consciously you were?
Okay. Yeah, of course. I mean, it's, but it was, getting to that was a very happened rather organically. I was really trying to please my mother, because my mother is a painter when I was a young painter. So I was trying to please her, you know, and paint the way she would feel would be the better way to paint, or the way to paint.
Was there any pleasing her?
Well, yes. I mean, I think in the end, she's appreciated the fact that I think we respect each other's work, and we have a very different way of working and visualizing, and mm-hmm. different qualities. But yes, I wasn't being myself, you know, and that never works. I mean, that's in terms of as an artist, you can't wear someone else's skin.
Right.
So,
So it's comfortable to do that for a while, for a lot of people, like to adopt
someone
else's outlook or something.
Yeah,
and then you outgrow it to a certain degree, you know?
Yes, but I felt a great emptiness. This was when I was in graduate school. Uh-huh. It was my first year of graduate school. And I felt a real sense of a kind of crisis, because I didn't feel connected to what I was making.
Mm.
That was when I really got into this tiny brushes, glazing,
mm-hmm.
pulled everything down, because I was making these huge 15-foot by 8-foot sort of figurative paintings, but they were kind of covert. The subject was covert, or was some. It was sort of sexual. It was sort of religious. It had some of the same qualities of my work
mm-hmm.
that, you know, has sort of unfortunately in some ways always had. But yeah, it was. Because of this crisis, I essentially kind of pulled inward, and I started making these very small devotional paintings that were explicitly sexual.
Right.
And that's when I really connected with who I was as a painter.
That's really interesting that you use the word devotional too, because that term rings so true to me, like the style of like Netherlandish painting to me.
Yes,
like
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Hans Memling, who Panofsky dedicated a chapter that was lovingly called The Insipid. Hans Memling. But there is like a sort of, I think he said he used that word because there's a sort of quietness mm-hmm. to them, and I feel
yes,
like that
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of is, you know, part of the work that you make somehow. There's like sort of this quietude to it,
yes,
even though there
meditate.
Might be some raunchy things happening.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. This sort of, well, that's where the, I mean, yeah, that's where this, there's a form, there is a strange kind of religiosity just in the act of it.
Yeah.
Of this stroking, the repetition, the.
Yeah, yeah, the waiting for things to dry and everything like that.
Or just the repetition of painting something over and over again, which is how I work. Whether I'm working with watercolor and painting an image over and over again, or I'm working with oil and I'm painting the image literally on the same panel over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about attachment that has been kind of the key for me, which is what happened with that very early work.
Now,
from the 90s.
When you mean over and over again, are you sanding down and then painting again?
No,
or?
I just mean that I'm not... When I was doing that early work, which was involved a lot of glazing, it was really made up of glaze. It was not.
Right.
It wasn't traditionally the way you make that kind of work. Is you have a really strong underpainting, and then you do a few layers of glaze on top of that underpainting, which
mm-hmm.
gives it a real solid kind of body and quality. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't working that way. I sort of taught myself how to do it. But that wasn't all it was about. It was about this kind of transparency, which has been of interest to me as well, and then luminosity, which has also been something that I've been interested in over time. So it was this kind of using a lot of medium, very little pigment, and many, many layers. So in a sense, I was constantly covering up and repainting what I had painted before.
Right, right, right.
And that, to me, was really about attachment, you know, to this sort of image, and then it would be finally done.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how why those paintings could go on for so long, and did go on for a long time at a certain point. Those paintings that took a long, long time.
I still get the sense, though, that you're still a very kind of slow and methodical worker. Is that sort of carried on?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, I'd imagine, you know, I'm a very impatient person, and I don't think I have, like, sort of part of being an artist, especially an object maker, painter, is like sort of figuring out your temperament and your relationship to the thing. Like, did you know what your temperament was? So it sounds like you did kind of early on, especially if it was in grad school. Like, for me, it took a while.
Yes.
But,
First year graduate school of a 3-year program. So, I was lucky in that I discovered myself within the first year of the graduate program, UCLA, and I got a lot of support for the work. And
right.
So it was, I was very fortunate.
So, like, when you are kind of working in between things, like, how do you ever deal with the sort of this vulture called boredom at all in the studio, do you ever sort of sense that sort of creeping into your practice at all? Not, I don't mean that in a negative way, but it's just sort of something that I feel like I always have to contend with all the time.
That's so interesting. I wonder how you do that. I don't think in the larger sense, I can't tolerate a kind of repetition past, in the sense that if there's nothing there to hold me, I don't get involved with the image.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always this sort of larger driving thing. That's why, like, I need to feel that the image can sustain me for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I get involved with an image.
Mm.
In terms of those 3-year paintings, I mean, those were, after about a year and 2 months, like a relationship. They were like relationships, and after about a year and 2 months or so, I would need a lot of outside
help.
Stimulation. You know,
right.
A lot of new music, a lot of coffee nips.
The honeymoon phase is over.
Yeah, the coffee nips were going in, right? I was like sucking every 10 minutes. A coffee nip will take 8 minutes to suck down to nothing. And then there was, you know, so there was, I was requiring a lot to get to the end.
Right.
The first year and 2 months would just kind of speed by. The last 6 months would speed by, and everything in between was just tough.
Right.
Hardcore.
Yeah, because you're watching an image, you know, kind of grow like, say like a grass will or something like it. You may not know exactly what it'll look like when it's done, but you know the transformation of the shadow and the light is a very slowly evolving thing. Like, as opposed to, you know, another painter who's going to completely change it over a course of a sitting. I'd imagine you would have to be incredibly engaged with that. With that subject to some degree. Now, the newer bodies of work that I've seen you, that's on your website, the sort of clawed mirror paintings.
Yeah.
Those are sort of emerged from a lot of layers as well, or
definitely.
Because I haven't seen them in person, so I'm not exactly sure.
Well,
yeah.
I should have you come by.
Yeah, I'd love to see them in person.
I have a couple left, or I have one left in the studio. I mean, those images were interesting because I was working from the reflections of the, take the photograph of a former girlfriend in the mirror and then work from the reflections. That's what those images were.
Work from the reflections in a mirror.
Yes, the black mirror in my bedroom, basically. So I had them, they each agreed to pose, and then the photographs were of the reflections, and then I worked with the images. Those were the images essentially that I worked from.
Oh, okay.
My interest was in kind of burying the image and so pushing it back. So that's what I was working with, and so I would bring it forward, or I'd put more information in and then kind of suppress it or bury it or basically dim it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, that was that process of layering, but also with the purpose of a kind of recessiveness and reduction, a kind of elimination,
right?
You know, and trying to retain something and see how far I could go with that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it whenever you're using, I'm sure you weren't like using just Mars Black out of the tube, but. I remind a little bit of those Ad Reinhardt paintings, because those kinds of paintings are impossible to photograph, and I feel like that particular body of work that you made is impossible to really kind of feel content having it photographed.
It was
like those things our physical experiences.
Exactly. I mean, it really was frustrating. Finally, Doug and Fran Parker, who are these amazing photographers, photographed it. But we had to have it photographed three times.
Wow.
It really was impossible. But even the photographs, I mean, they did this amazing job in capturing the paintings, but at the same time, yeah, they're so perceptual, those paintings.
Yeah.
The way they change with the light, things like that, that you think you see something, but you really sense it. And the whole experience of those paintings really is kind of about being present with them, in the space with them, and an intimate encounter with the object. And so, yeah, so it just, the images themselves actually make me nervous as images. I don't, you know, I don't particularly feel all that happy or proud of those images. It's more that but I know what happens in the presence of those paintings.
Yeah.
But the images themselves, you know, of course, I was very nervous about making those very conservative images.
Right, right, right.
I wasn't
right.
particularly, you know, confident about that.
Yeah, I mean, having an image, especially that you know it's going to be kind of impossible to get a hold of through a photograph, especially like, also I was about to say, like, it reminds me, like, kind of you kind of had to go through the 90s when it was a so-called very unpopular time to make paintings.
Oh yeah,
I mean, was that something that you ever made you even reconsider, like maybe you should try something else? Or was it, were you ever dissuaded at all from actually, like, facing these kind of problems that painters have?
Oh, God. And then figurative paintings.
Yeah, and figurative paintings,
although,
no less.
You know, but figurative painting then became kind of chic at some point, you know.
Right.
You know? But not the kind of figurative painting I make, which I think, understandably so. I mean, it's
right.
It's, you know, anomalous work. Just in general, but I think really in terms of American figurative painting, I don't particularly feel necessarily in alignment with a lot of it.
Right.
But I, of course, admire it. I just don't. It's not. It doesn't seem to be something I can do.
Right.
So.
But when you were in grad school, were there people just going like, why are you doing this?
No, no. In fact, I mean, that was UCLA at the time, which was kind of remarkable, you know, because Paul McCarthy was there when I was there.
Right.
Charlie Ray was making his figurative sculpture. Larry Pittman was there. Of course, Patty Wickman, who I worked with closely. So it wasn't like...
And Amy Adler was in your class at the time, right?
Amy came in right after me.
Okay, so she...
We were like ships in the night.
Right, so you guys...
She, in fact, took my studio.
Oh, wow.
She inherited my little studio with a door. I had a door.
But she was making works that dealt with the body.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But in a sense, I think figurative work at UCLA was very this idea of the figurative and a kind of performative, and which is something that actually I'm interested in, that Amy is obviously interested in. So this kind of way of thinking about the body was what was going on there. And so I didn't feel, and I got a lot of support from like Nancy Rubens, and very, you know, unusual people were very supportive of my work. So I didn't feel like I had to stop. I felt like I was onto something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always feel like the talk about painting being, you know, having an inhospitable sort of time. I never really get the sense that anybody was like, well, I just had to stop, man. I just had to pick up a bandsaw. And I mean, I've heard that now with some people that were making, you know, large C prints for, you know, people. Some people have, you know, kind of felt like photography has kind of hit a wall, and they were just, okay, I gotta do something else with it. And you're starting to see younger people kind of treat a photograph like a physical object the way you would with a painting, but faking it sort of through post-production techniques and sculptural techniques and all these kinds of things. But anyway, like, I just never got the sense that anybody who went through those inhospitable times actually, like, felt it that much. Yeah. So it seems kind of
a lot of painters don't stop painting. Honestly, it's never since the 70s, it's been really kind of, you know, questionable to be a painter in a sense, really.
Absolutely.
And so I don't know. I mean, but yet, you know, we persist. I don't. Yeah.
That's all one can do. And did you find that that your mother was ever like hypercritical of anything that you were doing sort of later, in terms of was she ever coming into your studio and giving you a hard time about anything?
I remember this one time when she came to my studio. This was before I had shown this work to her. I'm trying to remember. I was working on my first orgy painting. And she, this is hilarious, and it was actually quite touching. She dropped over, and I think she dropped over to the studio, which she never did.
Mm.
And to the studios, the Warner Studios. And I remember other students sort of warning, thank God I had the door to the studio, because I was the one student that had the door to
right.
the studio. And I remember other students kind of saying, oh, it was Carol Davis, and she said, your mom's here, you know. Because my studio was full of this gay male porn, which was like this SM porn. I was making this little orgy painting, this piss painting. I really was terrified of her seeing it, obviously. And I think did I hide it? I don't know if I hid it or not. And she came in, and she saw another painting I was working on that I had stopped working on that was just a large figure. She didn't see the small painting. And I was hugely relieved, but I was terrified. I'm trying to remember if my aunt was with her. I don't think she was alone, but I was, I mean, yeah, so no, I mean, she really hasn't, she never, no, she didn't, I think, you know, honestly, I think that it hasn't been the most comfortable thing for her, but I don't, she would never tell me so.
Right. Yeah, because my mom would always, like, say, you should use prettier colors or something. Like, she'd always be, like, very blunt, like, kind of blunt sometimes.
You know, no, not so much. I mean, yeah. You know, when I'm done with a painting, I'll always ask my mom to come by and look at it.
That's really nice.
Yeah. Wow. And she does. And so we'll have a discussion about, you know, I'll ask her if there's something that bothers her. And she'll say this or that, and then I'll say, well, I wanted that. And then she'll be like, oh, okay, well, if that's what you... you know. But usually, yeah, it's not... I think that, you know, I think it's been hard for her because she's had to explain the work to her friends or to others that are of her generation and
right.
aren't in the art world. And she's had to explain my work to people that might. So that has, I would say, has been more uncomfortable for her.
Right.
Than
Which
I
isn't
think
the
our
worst
own,
thing. Yeah.
Our own dialogue around my work. It's really more about the outside, her milieu and her friends and her. That aren't really necessarily connected to the art world.
Right.
And wouldn't understand why I'm making this. Or family members who felt that it was immoral, what I was doing. And that kind of thing. She's had to encounter that more than I have had to. She's
right.
had to sort of face that more than I have had to.
Do you think that there is anything kind of immoral at all in sexuality and its depiction?
It's a really good question. I think, oh, God. Immoral. I find it so difficult to think of these questions because to me sexuality isn't, there's nothing immoral about sexuality.
Nothing inherent, but in its depiction there's always, of course...
Complications, yes,
yeah.
of objectification, I think,
yeah.
really, of the body and sexuality and consumption of the sexual body.
The consumption is the part
yeah.
that I have the most trouble with when
yeah.
I think about it because... Yeah. Like, I do think pornography exists for a really good reason in the same way that alcohol does or any of those things. And I feel like it's overconsumption is the problem and it's accessibility, high, easy accessibility. Like, especially when I grew up in the 80s, like, you had to track down a VHS tape and have the actual object in your hand and then take it back to your house and
right,
usually had
right.
a bunch of other kids your same age going to watch it together, so nobody's actually like using it in the way that people use it now that's so accessible to your phone or so I
right,
just feel
right.
like, you know, I was joking to somebody the other day, like, they should have like whatever website that has porn, you should have like, this is an addictive substance, you know, that could, you know, do this to you, do that to you, and it's not an accurate depiction of
right,
sexuality
right,
the way
right.
most people, you know. I
yeah,
just, that's my
yeah.
sort of sense of it. It's consumption. Like, anything under the mm-hmm. sun, I'm fine with anyone doing, and under, you know, as long as no one's hurting anybody, I guess. Or at least
yeah, exactly.
at least consensually
right.
doing it.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
I think what's difficult and what can be troubling is that sometimes what's coming across. There's such a distortion. There can be a real distortion of, especially, I don't know, female sexuality seems somewhat distorted by pornography, to me anyway.
Right.
And often.
Distorted in what way, do you think?
Well, I don't know that I don't know. I have. It's not that I don't really watch all that much porn so much, I guess. But I think, well, I don't know. I mean, also, I don't have, you know, I'm not heterosexual, so I don't exactly know that what that dynamic is.
Right.
But I think it seems to me like the images or the porn can sometimes just seem that the woman seems to me somewhat, I don't know, passive, or there's something very cliche about the whole thing.
Right.
And then when you think about SM sex, for instance, you get the same kinds of cliches.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same kinds of cliches, but the same element of cliche.
Right.
And theater and just this sort of the rituals and the sort of roles and all of these things that people do around sexuality, which I think is really rather uninteresting. It has nothing to do with what actually can go on or does go on, really.
Yeah.
When you have an intimate relationship with someone, which is really frightening, I think, which is what makes sex so interesting, is that it is somewhat frightening, and you know, you can really push up against your things you don't really know about yourself, and hidden aspects of oneself, which really are fascinating to me, which is part of why I'm so interested in working with it as a material. Apart from the fact, getting back to figurative painting, that it just it creates a different relationship of the viewer, I think, to the object that they're looking at.
Right.
It immediately opens up a kind of visceral channel that I don't know that is necessarily always, you know, accessed through other forms of image making.
Yeah, I totally agree. Would you have made contact with another painting or object in a museum to recent memory that had that sort of effect on you, that felt like you had a sort of kinship with the artist, long dead or maybe still alive?
But I couldn't even tell you what the name of this painter is. It's so frustrating for me because every time I'm in Paris, and I go often enough, I go to the Louvre and I walk through the horrible hall of painting, which I just despise, and despise painting while I'm walking through that hall. And that's when I hate being a painter, and I just hate figurative painting, and I hate the whole, all the diagonals and all of the sort of theatrics and the hysterics of figurative painting, and I just despise it. And it's so it's also mediocre, it's also over the, it's so bad. But there's always, but then there's the, you know, the little, the ones that you have to see every time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, Corot for me right now has been someone that I've really been enjoying looking at. But I don't know the name of this painter, but I had the experience when I was making the Black Mirror paintings I went to the Louvre and I saw that there's this painting that was done. And it's a man. It's actually a portrait of the artist's wife, and it's quite a beautiful picture of a woman just gazing at the viewer or at the painter, and the expression of love on her face, or the experience of love that I felt standing there, was so remarkable.
Mm.
I felt his love in the depiction of her, and her love somehow in the gaze. And there was something quite remarkable that I felt in this kind of triangulated experience of being the painter, seeing her, sort of experiencing her gaze, and feeling the love that was experienced by him in the depiction of her and creating this image of her. And there was something that I just understood really about painting and about love and about what I was working on at the time.
It's like a platonic threesome experience you kind of had, you know?
Well, I didn't feel it to be platonic. I felt it to be quite immersive, you know, which is how painting, for me, can function at its best, is this kind of, I would say, almost supernatural sort of experience.
Wow.
That's a great experience with painting.
Well, if there's any of you painting nerds listening, please let either Monica or myself know who this possibly could be.
I can tell you. I can, because I'm going to leave. I'm going to go soon, so I'll write it down and text.
Yeah, please do. Yeah. So now is a good time to maybe go into the Yvonne Rainer clip that you wanted me to play.
Okay.
For my stock question that I ask all my guests. Monica chose a clip from the film about a woman who, ellipse after that, made in 1974 by Yvonne Rainer. And do you mind setting up why this particular film
and why this clip?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a heavy question somehow. And I know this,
I should say, how does it affect it? How does it sort of reconfigure your approach to your work or your life somehow, do you think? If you could maybe say.
I have to be honest, I didn't discover this film until not that long ago.
Okay.
Maybe about 8 years ago, 9 years ago now.
That's kind of a while.
It has been a while, yeah. I could ruminate on that. I think what I found so inspiring about the film, which has of course been an important film for many people, I think, is just that I think for me it was identifying another artist who had worked with autobiographical material, with ideas of the image in a kind of, I would call it expressionistic way.
Mm-hmm.
In a time when that really wasn't being done so much, to talk about a sort of feminist sensibility where she was essentially embodying that by working with herself as a kind of central character in terms of the emotional content of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But the presentation of this the personal and the sexual and the sort of the relationship as being the subject somehow, that's the stable subject in the film. The mm-hmm. emotionality is the stable sort of structure or the basis of the film, whereas the sort of the formal aspects and the structure is all sort of fragmented and unstable.
Hmm.
So I think that's what interests me in particular about film about a woman who is really the fact that Yvonne was working with this material in the early 70s in a way that was about a kind of embodied feminism, I would say.
Hmm.
And sort of the autobiographical, and I feel that sense of connection, I guess. And so in a way, that's what's been inspiring to me in particular. And that clip, I think what's moving to me about that clip, of course it's a very visually sort of stunning, I think, image where the couple is rolling on, you know, the man and women are kind of rolling
mm-hmm.
over each other on the beach, and it's taken from this very severe sort of foreshortened perspective.
Yeah.
And then Yvonne's voice comes, sort of a voiceover when she talks about an actual experience that she had from a particular relationship that was very intense for her, which was her relationship with Robert Morris. And she describes this idyllic period before she was sort of deeply kind of betrayed by him and shocked by something that he did. So this sort of, I think what also really intrigues me about this film really is, again, which kind of reflects back on my work, is the sort of factuality of it all. This is all factual material that she's working with.
Hmm.
And if you know the story, if you've read her memoirs, for instance, you'll understand what this clip actually is about, or references.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's play the clip, and then we'll be right back for just a little bit before we have to end. But for now, just stay tuned. There might be a little bit of silence before, because in the parts where there's no narration, there's no sound, pretty much,
no,
right?
No, there's no sound, yeah.
So... So just hold tight. All right, we'll be right back.
Then she remembers what the scene had reminded her of. The sky with its leaden clouds, the wet spray of the sea, the thump of surf against the rocks. The 2 weeks had fled past them. She didn't remember a single argument, not even the kind of maneuvering for brief privateness that people do when they are together constantly. At this remove, it seemed impossibly idyllic. Looking at those 2 weeks against the backdrop of later events, she was at a loss to understand the nature of his feelings. She herself felt like a fool thinking about it, deceived and humiliated. But she also felt a deep sadness. There was no denying her own happiness and sense of completion at the time. Had he ever felt such things in her presence for even a single moment? She wondered.
Okay. Thank you for sticking around there. All in the moment of silence, you're just seeing, like Monica described, like a couple sort of rolling on the beach, and there's a severely foreshortened sort of view of them. And then you just see at the very top, there's like this horizon line with the like a thin strip of the ocean. You can actually check out the whole film on Ubu.com. So please do that. It's while you were describing this, and also your own approach to your work earlier, it's sort of funny. Like you sort of have this data from your personal experience and peers' experiences that feeds the work, and it's funny. Like my work, which also has a lot of sexual imagery, and I cull from the most cliche of cliche of cliche things to figure out what I even think about it. I don't even, I'm almost like weirdly so repressed that I don't understand what my own experience is. So I have to experience it through a mediated cliche experience to have some kind of understanding of where I am. So it's almost like a weird, I almost have like you describing that sort of made me realize like, wow, I'm, like,
we're inside out. We're,
exactly.
Like bipolar.
So that's a kind of a funny moment.
That's interesting.
So that said, we only have a few more minutes left of the show before Christina shows up for hers. But what are you going to be doing? Any projects coming up anytime soon? I should ask.
Yes. Well, I'm working on a new body of work, which is sort of unique. White line woodcuts, working with gay male porn from the late 70s on a magazine called Blue Boy. So that's what I'm working on now. And I'm, just sort of, with me, there's always a long period of making the work. So that's what I'm, I just sort of started this. So I'm excited about it.
Have you worked with woodcuts before?
No, not really. Never woodcuts. So I, you know, I've been exploring that and got into Japanese woodblock printmaking and things like that.
Great.
Yeah.
And are there any sort of set plans to show them anywhere right now?
Not
or?
Yet, no.
Okay.
No.
So it's gestating, we should say.
Yeah.
And being that you're a professor, you probably had the summer off. Did you get to travel anywhere this summer, or are you just sticking around?
I'm going to go to Paris in a couple of weeks.
Okay, so you're going to tell us, or tell me, rather,
tell
the name
painting.
Of that painter. Okay. Yeah, so
I'm
you
report back.
And you've been working with the same gallery there for a very long time, right?
Yeah, 20 years.
That's amazing.
Yes.
So you've gotten to know the city pretty well.
Yes, yes, I love the city. My mother actually has a place there, and so I've, for the last 35 years or so, it's been a kind of home away from home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what is your favorite museum there, aside from the Louvre?
Oh, boy. Oh, that's hard. Well, I couldn't say there is a favorite besides the Louvre, because I can't, I think I go there mostly.
I always feel like, you know, like, that's the place everyone should go when they go to Paris. Of course you should. Yeah. It's the Louvre. But I also feel like there's probably all these other weird museums there that
well,
probably...
Well, there's the Gustave Moreau Museum, which is quite magical. There's the Delacroix Museum. There's the...
There's a Delacroix Museum?
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. And then there's also... I love the Brancusi studio. That's wonderful, too.
I think I went to the Rodin studio, too.
Yeah,
which,
I haven't done that one.
Yeah, that one's funny. It's got some, like... third-rate paintings by very famous, like he had like you had like a third-rate Munch painting and like you know like the in-between paintings that some people make like and you give them away or whatever. before there were
the artist trades.
Yeah, exactly. Like that was kind of amusing to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. So it's the Louvre all the way for you.
Kind of. I mean, that's the one I go to every time I'm there. Right. To see the same paintings over and over again.
Yeah. And maybe this is the ultimate last question, aside from the trucker question I was about to ask. Like, what are the, besides from that painting you just described earlier, what other paintings do you like to go see over and over?
Well, I'm a huge Ingres fan. I mean, he was my kind of pivotal person, especially in the early 90s.
Yeah,
when I was developing that.
He's the man.
Style. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, it's always those portraits. And then I've been, of course, looking at the de la Tour and Corot and Chardin. Those are the painters I go to see.
Right. The holy triumvirate.
Yes.
Right.
And Corot. Yeah.
And so the last question is, you're in a truck driving across Texas. What is your cargo?
So hard.
What is, what drug are you on? And what's dead or living celebrities in the car with you, cab with you, and what is playing on the radio?
Shall I go in reverse?
No, whatever. Usually people say cargo first.
Cargo first. Wildflowers and Radical Fairies with Lanterns.
That's the best cargo answer I've heard so far. Okay, that's good.
Thank you. And my companion is Juliette Binoche because she's maybe my libidinal ideal. I think at some level.
Wow.
She must be because I think I need something to help me make the drive sort of more to go faster or something.
What's your favorite film that she acted in, do you think?
Oh my God, that's a hard one.
She's been in so many, it's hard for me to know.
And so many good ones. And yeah. There's something about her that's so raw, so transparent, that I just find her just delicious to watch.
Yeah. She's kind of gentle in comparison, though, to like Isabelle Huppert. Seems so
absolutely. Oh,
severe.
She's great. Yes.
Yeah, she's
yes.
great too, but there's such a different vibe.
Absolutely.
From her. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, I love her recent release, Sills of San Maria, or
sounds like Sally Sold Seat. Sounds like kind of a tongue twister.
I'm embarrassed to say I've been watching it, but anyway, she's quite remarkable in that one. She's sort of playing an actress like herself, I think, with Kristen. What is her actress name? Kristen
Wiig?
The vampire girl that was in all the vampire.
Oh, movies. Kristen Stewart.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's kind of a great film.
Huh. And then so Juliette Binoche is in the cab with you, and then what drug are you on?
Half a Xanax.
So you're open to just driving the truck right into a tree or something at some point. So me, I'm assuming both of you have helmets on or something. Maybe, hopefully Juliette will just take the wheel when you're passed out. You know? And then what's playing on the radio?
Joni Mitchell's A Case of You.
Oh, great. I heard she got ill recently.
Yes.
Is she okay now? I don't know.
We hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also a painter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fitting. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that's about does it. Do you feel good about it? Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on the show, and thanks to any of you who have been listening. Apologies for starting late, but these things happen. The world's crazy. So I will hopefully hear from you in 2 weeks, and I'll announce it on Facebook who the next guest is. But thank you for joining me, and have a pleasant evening. Goodbye.